Welcome to this third episode of our podcast series, The Paper Trail, from the Netherlands Journal of Geosciences. My name is Henk Kombrink, and in my position as the editor-in-chief, I'm asking authors of papers published in our journal about the highlights of their research, but also the driving forces behind performing the study. Just to make research papers more accessible, through allowing the authors to tell a bit about what goes on behind the scenes of producing scientific papers. In this edition, I'm talking to Sander Hoeben from TNO, the Geological Survey of the Netherlands. Sander is a geologist with a strong background in biostratigraphy and has worked for TNO for almost 10 years now. Together with co-author and researcher Geert-Jan Vis, Sander recently published a paper on the age dating of the oldest recovered sedimentary strata from the Netherlands. Welcome, Sander.
Thank you.
Well, and obviously, the first question I'm going to ask you is, how old are these oldest recovered strata from the Netherlands?
I don't know, I have a bit of a disappointing answer, because we can't tell with a super high level of accuracy. So I would say latest Silurian to earliest Devonian.
Right. And how many millions of years is that?
Yeah, from the top of my head, that is within the order of, let's say, 410 to 420 million years ago.
Well, that's still pretty old for the Netherlands.
It absolutely is.
So, yeah, let's talk about, well, how you arrived at this conclusion, etc. But first of all, what was the trigger to find out a bit more about all this?
Yeah, the trigger essentially goes down to working on our what we call litostratigraphic nomenclature. So geologists tend to speak in terms of rocks, in terms of litostratigraphic units, which typically have a name often derived from a certain region, the place where a type section has been defined, for instance. And that litostratigraphy is well settled for everything down to, I would say, the early Carboniferous. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you hit the Devonian, everything is informal. And that is, of course, driven by the fact that there's only very few well penetrations into those strata. And also because age dating becomes very difficult due to a general lack of fossils, but also ways to radiometrically assess those ages. And if you then go to, for instance, Dino Loket, and you're going to look at some wells in Zeeland, you will see that these wells have, in capital letters, Silurian as one of the litostratigraphic units. And about 3 years ago, myself as a biostratigrapher started to wonder, okay, how do we know that this is the case? And then we dived into some legacy reports, and we essentially found out that there's a lot of circular reasoning involved, and that there is not a single report that unambiguously demonstrates that precise age. So that's essentially how this line of research was born.
Right.
To see if we could biostratigraphically test this, I would say, hypothesis at that end.
Right. And so, yeah, so you found these wells that actually drilled these sedimentary strata. And if you found these wells, obviously, what was actually the reason for cutting core in these wells? What was the kind of rationale behind doing all this? Because there is no oil or gas over there in that area, isn't it?
No, there's essentially two wells that go into the what we call Caledonian basements, or however you want to call that. And I think the first one drilled was 0181, mm-hmm. which is drilled a bit offshore Zeeland, about 70 meters off the coastline. And what I heard recently while talking to a colleague here, that was Kees who told me that, Kees Geel, is that Placid got this license area, and they were obliged to drill a well. And when they encountered those strata, they decided to also cut a core in there, essentially for scientific purposes, to get an understanding of that section.
I see.
But by the time that we were initiating this small research, we could not get access to 0181, which I recently did get, and there's actually samples on my desk now to also check it in that well. But also Kortgene 1 was drilled mm-hmm. in the 80s. That was drilled by NAM to essentially test hydrocarbon accumulations in the Dynensian, so in the lower Carboniferous limestones, but they went deeper and also cut a core in the Caledonian basement. So the reason is oil and gas exploration, that they were drilled, but going beyond the conventional target, I would say.
Yeah, I see. And in a way, it's a surprise, isn't it? That so they cut these cores, which comes at quite a cost, and then didn't perform any biostratigraphic analysis on them.
I guess that, I mean, if you go back to the reports, then there have been some attempts to perform biostratigraphic analysis, also including palynology, but the processing steps at that time were not as sophisticated as they are now, so they were not able to derive any myospores. A second thing that plays a role here is that if you look at the, let's say, lithological characteristics of those cores, it is, of course, also a very logical conclusion to infer that they correlate to the same strata that are well known from the Brabant Massif area to the south in Belgium. So there's also a lithological guidance towards that.
Okay, so let's step back a bit. So we are looking at two wells in the south of the Netherlands. So, and it's for a reason that, okay, in that area, it is fairly, the deepest rocks of the Netherlands are at a fairly shallow level. Yeah. So why is that? What is the kind of geological setting?
Yeah, I think a very important term to introduce here is the so-called Brabant Massif, or the Lommen Brabant Massif, which can essentially be envisaged as an ancient mountain belt that's subsequently got eroded. And the basic idea is that the main phase of mountain building of the Brabant Massif is related to large-scale continental collision towards the, let's say, the early to mid Devonian. And during that time of compression, these old rocks that were deposited in the Silurian and the earliest Devonian were pushed to relatively shallow depths, and they still make part of that, let's say, structure in the subsurface as we know today. And obviously, that mountain belt became subsequently eroded. But it was a period of relief in the early and mid Devonian.
Yeah, and which is still very much a structure which can be seen in the subsurface very nicely.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
If you go to areas close to Brussels, for instance, you can find the core of the Brabant Massif at the surface, yielding Cambrian deposits. So rocks dating back to the radiation of life.
Yeah. So once you kind of got access to these cores from Kortrijk, for instance, how did you then go about and ultimately found those myospores or these fossils in there?
Yeah, so what you essentially do is you go for core samples, obviously, because with cuttings, the only thing you will find are things that actually drop down into your sample from overlying strata. But luckily, there were three core intervals in the pre-Carboniferous in Kortrijk 1. And we sampled those and sent them to a specialized lab in Wales, who are very experienced with working of these highly mature samples. So they have a series of chemicals to, first of all, get rid of the silicates. You use hydrofluoric acid to that end. It's a fairly dangerous substance. You get rid of any carbonates that I don't expect to be in there, actually, with HCl. And then you apply a series of oxidation steps to essentially clean up what we call the macerals or the kerogen, which is all the organic matter that's still out there. And then you sieve that over a series of mesh sizes to concentrate for different fossil groups like chitinozoans and eventually also myospores. And then I simply get a package by the mail containing the microscope slides, and I put them under the microscope. And surprisingly, I saw very ugly and fairly dark colored, also ruptured myospores. But I was like, okay, this, I can do something with this. This might be some way of, for the first time, elucidating the age of those rocks. And then I got in touch with people who know a lot more about these the my sports of this age via email and also by visiting some specialists in the University of Liège to actually put some names to these fossils. And then you can start comparing what is known from the literature in terms of the first and the last occurrences of these myospore species. And then particularly for the lowest core in Kortgene 1, we got as I said, with the uncertainty that's there, so earliest Devonian to latest Silurian age for that assemblage.
Yeah. And I am not a biostratigrapher at all. So can you maybe tell me, just back to the basics, what is a myospore?
Yeah. So everybody knows plants, obviously.
Yeah.
And if you consider the evolution of plants, it's very interesting to note that also when you look at macrofossils, so large fossils that you can actually really use to identify a typical plant, they were always thought to date back to the Silurian. But more recent work from very well-preserved associations, for instance, in Saudi Arabia, has now shown that the first land plants are even a bit older, likely late Ordovician in age. So that's about 500 million years ago. But a big radiation occurred towards the late Silurian in that plants started to make what we call vesicles. So they become able to transport water in a more efficient way. And via that way, they started to colonize the land, which then led to a subsequent radiation of plants during the Devonian. I think the Devonian is, for the marine people, known as the age of the fishes, but for terrestrial people, it's known as the age of the plants. So we are looking at this interval where plants started to colonize the land, if you will. But the nice thing about plants, I mean, for a biostratigrapher, it's always very difficult if you completely rely on those macrofossils, because the chance that they are preserved in a core is super minimal, of course.
Yeah.
But luckily, plants always, as part of their life cycle, also have a reproduction tract, let's say. And you can, for instance, see that at the base of a fern, if you turn around the leaf of a fern, you can see these sporangia, as they call them. And those are the areas where spores are made. And these spores are typically dispersed. They lead to the proliferation of a small, what we call gametophyte, so a small copy of that plant. And then when it undergoes sexual reproduction, the large fern again produces. But it is those tiny spores that we look at. And the term myospore tells something about the size. So you have macrospores, which are large ones, typically made by water ferns. And you have myospores, which are mid-sized, let's say.
Ah, right. So because I've been looking at these kind of reports on myospores frequently during my PhD, and it's only now that you're telling me that it's the word myo tells you something about the size of the spores.
Exactly. And it is a bit, it's something of the Paleozoic world, because myself, I'm coming more from the Jurassic and also the Cenozoic, and then we simply talk about spores. But in the Paleozoic, there always has a lot of controversy of what is a spore, what is a so-called cryptospore, because we are really looking at the incipient stages of biological evolution.
Right. No, well, that's really good to know.
But in essence, you see those spores and you dive into the literature and try to stick a name to them. And that's when you can start comparing with other localities where there are some more independent age calibrations available.
Yes. So and again, going back to that moment, you got the slides, you looked at them under the microscope. Did you have a certain expectation as to what to find, and were you positively surprised, or was it fairly difficult to find any reliable spores in there?
There's one particular species that is clearly confined to that time interval. It's a so-called Ambitisporites group, and I was very happy to find that, because that's kind of you always watch for observational bias, but that kind of confirms the Silurian expectations we had. And for the rest, it is always a little bit difficult as a biostratigrapher that some of the other interpretations are also based on the absence of species you would find over the course of the Devonian, which, given the poor preservation nature of this material, is what you have to deal with.
Yeah. So you were saying they looked very dark, and so I kind of got the feeling you wanted to say cooked.
Cooked. No, that's precisely it. Yeah, they're very mature.
So does that mean that these rocks were initially buried a lot deeper and were uplifted again?
Exactly, yeah. So I think already during, let's say, early Devonian times, prior to the uplift of the massif, they are in a very deep Portland basin, let's say. So it's not unsurprising that happened already to that time, but also obviously later over the course of the Carboniferous and also the Mesozoic, there has been extensive burial there.
Yeah. So you've got these Maya spores now. So if you looked at that under the microscope, but can you tell a bit about the types of sediments that they were from? So about deposition environments, etc. Yeah. Have you got any idea or ideas about that?
Particularly the 0181 well has beautiful cores throughout this interval, which are also slabbed, so you can study them in very high detail. And they are very dark, typically fine grained, yet still silicic clastic. They don't contain an awful lot of carbonate, and they have these very intricate, isolated, lighter colored, essentially coarsening upward sandstone repetitions that are with a very sharp erosional base that by Geert Jan, who's a sedimentologist, are interpreted as turbidites. So we're looking at fairly deep water sediments that typically contain a lot of fine grained deposits that rain out in this relatively distal setting, and then occasionally some coarser grained gravity transported material is introduced into the basin. So you're looking at deep water fans as an example.
Yeah. And does that apply to the kind of late Silurian, lower Devonian or early Devonian section, or is that the later?
Yeah, the later section is a bit more difficult to interpret, also because the RH constraints remain very poor in that section. But in terms of sedimentology, what you see overall is that, for instance, in S51, there's also a beautiful course there. It's different. It seems less deformed, so tectonically deformed. And I tend to interpret those rocks more as shallower water, so maybe tempestite. So it's overall fine-grained silicic clastics, but with more sand content.
Yeah.
So that would be a lot shallower in terms of depositional environment.
Right. And how do these observations in terms of what the depositional setting looked like at the time fit into the overall paleogeography? Can you tell a bit about where these sediments may actually come from?
Yeah, I think for the Silurian, that is a very good question. And for the later Devonian, I think there is a better understanding. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's easier to start with the younger Devonian into the Carboniferous.
Okay.
Because there's a bit more understanding of the paleogeographic context. Although on the other hand, maybe starting with the Silurian is more easy, is more logical, since it's older. Let's start with the oldest part.
Okay.
So in terms of paleogeography, and with paleogeography, I now essentially mean where the continents were with respect to where the sea was.
Yeah.
Is that by we are in this world that looks completely different from as it looks today. Yeah? During most of the what we call early Paleozoic, so in the Ordovician and the early Silurian, there's a huge continent essentially on the South Pole. That's what we call Gondwana. And then, and it's also interesting to note that the Netherlands, the present day position of the Netherlands, should be moved essentially to about 30 degrees southern latitude, so almost the area where you today would find Angola, for instance.
Yeah.
So that's completely different. But let's look at the world as it did. So we have Gondwana on the South Pole, a huge continent. And then towards the north of that, still on the southern hemisphere, we have a series of smaller continents, which are called Laurentia, Baltica, and a small microcontinent that essentially stretch from what's now Nova Scotia to what's now let's say, Western Europe. So we're at the eastern part of that that ancient continent called Avalonia. And between those three continents and Gondwana, there was a big ocean, which we call the Rayic Ocean. Yeah. And over the course of the early Paleozoic, that ocean closed. Yeah? So with that ocean closing, you essentially get a very deep foreland basin on the southern margin of Avalonia. And that's where, in that foreland basin, I kind of envisaged that these sediments were deposited. But the interesting thing is that within those microscope slides, I find these myospores, which have a Silurian age, but I also find marine algae called acritarchs that have an even older age, so Cambrian to Ordovician, which means that they were somehow eroded somewhere and then flushed into that ancient ocean basin, which means that something of the Cambrian to Ordovician age was coming up already by Silurian times. And the idea is that that might have been some of the arc systems that got emplaced with the closure of that ocean basin. So a very complex tectonic situation, I would say, with a closing ocean basin continental collision that eventually led to a major mountain building phase.
And do you think that these sediments then are arrived from the from the south, where
that's my hypothesis. Yes. Whereas I suspect that the terrestrial myospores, as we call them, are more logically to be derived from the north, where of course the large proto old red continent was already developing.
And also in the early Devonian already.
But I mean, this, I think this is very much into the hypothetical domain.
Of course.
Since I simply looked at.
So and when you go to the late Devonian, you said you've got a bit more control as to how things looked like at the time.
Yeah. So in the late Devonian, we know a lot more. Also because a lot of wells are drilled, of course, further to the north towards what we call the Mid North Sea High. And yeah, for everybody who has once looked at an upper Devonian core from the North Sea area, you're familiar with those red sandstones. Yeah. So you look at these red continental sandstones that were part of what we call this large old red continent that developed towards the north. And we also know that let's say in the Nemurian or within the early Carboniferous, let's say. Towards the southern part of the Netherlands, we start developing this Variscan IV deep. We get a lot of essentially a new foreland basin developed. So essentially, you look at a geometry where your most of your land is in the north, and your ocean basin in the late Devonian. I shouldn't say ocean basin, but your seas are to the south. And it's also you find in the Ardennes, you find a lot of Upper Devonian, Frannian to Fennian reefs and stromatoporoids, and it's clearly a marine depositional environment towards that end. And in the Zeeland area, you're essentially a little bit in between, perhaps. Yeah? You're in a shallow marine environment, but it has always been very difficult to age date those sediments. And also in our paper, we are not really sure what the precise age of that is, except that we recently find some Frannian myospores in another well that I recently looked at. So that story is now closing a bit more.
Yeah, good. Well, I think this is a great summary, Sander. And I had actually one more question. I think you already alluded to this in one of your answers, is that it seems like you're doing some follow-up work at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, so what we are, there's a couple of things happening now. We are working on a new chapter on the Book of the Geology of the Netherlands, which also contains a chapter called pre-Carboniferous, or pre-late Carboniferous, where we actually learned a lot about the Devonian over the past, 15 years. There have been some geothermal wells drilled in the Venlo area that shed some important light on the lithological characteristics of the Devonian. There are some wells in South Limburg drilled as well. And also in Belgium, there has been a lot of new insights on the stratigraphy there locally. So we're trying to bridge that gap and trying to now propose a formal lithostratigraphic nomenclature for the Devonian, since there are so much more information available. So
yeah,
I'm working on a report of that, and there will be this new chapter in the new book on the geology of the Netherlands.
And did you also mention that you kind of did find these cores from 0181 now to further study?
We did. They were in, so Placid was taken over in multiple rounds, and eventually their obligation on these cores ended up with what is now, after a whole series of mergers, called Neptune, I think, which means that they were in Lingen, and Geert Jan was able to sample those. He currently lives in Hannover, so for him that was an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
And they are currently on my desk and also yielding fossils.
Oh, excellent. So that's going to be another paper.
Yeah, perhaps not a paper, because I've already seen that they contain exactly the same association. So it's
right. Okay.
Supportive evidence, I would say.
I see, yeah. And for the Silurian, are you going to include a Silurian lithostratigraphic name in the new nomenclature?
I'm very much inclined to do so, but let's see what the community thinks about that.
Okay.
Because I'm not the only one on my own deciding it.
Of course. Okay, of course, I understand. Well, we've been talking for, or you have been talking for about half an hour now, so I think it's a good time to wrap up. Sander, thanks very much for being able to dedicate your time to this.
My pleasure.
I think this is a really nice way of telling a bit more of a background to what the paper is about. So I think that helps. So thanks very much again, Sander. This was the third episode of our podcast series, The Paper Trail, from the Netherlands Journal of Geosciences. So thanks for listening, and see you again soon. Bye.